An Iranian missile attack in Jordan killed two Americans. The Pentagon has acknowledged that. CBS News has learned something else. Dozens of U.S. military personnel injured last week in other regional Iranian attacks. There is another side to the Trump immigration crackdown: federal arrests for assaulting or impeding law enforcement. More than 550 cases filed, nearly half have collapsed for lack of evidence. Vice President J.D. Vance and wife Usha celebrate the birth of their fourth child. Our Olivia Rinaldi has all the history of children born to vice presidents. It's been 156 years. And pro tip, you'll want to brush up on Skylar Colfax. Hello, everyone. I'm Major Garrett in Washington. Let me welcome you to The Takeout. The Iran war trend lines right now are deadly, escalatory, and quite possibly alarming. The U.S. launched its ninth consecutive day of aerial assaults on targets within Iran. The tempo has been fierce. Press releases repeatedly describe degrading Iranian missile and drone capabilities. And yet, Iran keeps firing. This does not question the capabilities of the U.S. military. It does, however, speak to an Iranian stubbornness that can inflict the worst imaginable damage. Evidence of that came this weekend, a missile strike against a U.S. base in Jordan that killed two U.S. service personnel. A third American died in Iraq as part of an effort to defuse an Iranian drone. 17 Americans have died in this war. President Trump will attend the dignified transfer of these most recent casualties at Dover Air Force Base tomorrow. Trump vowed on social media today that Iran will pay, quote, many times over, unquote, for each American combat death. CBS News has learned that dozens of U.S. military personnel were injured this past week by Iranian missile strikes across the Middle East. The Pentagon says most have returned to service, but only acknowledged these injuries after asked about them by CBS News. Iran launched a missile attack on Bahrain today. It launched three more missiles at Jordan. Each was intercepted. Also, an explosive-laden drone was shot down near an airbase in Iraq that houses U.S. Special Operations Forces. And the British said a vessel trying to transit the Strait of Hormuz was attacked near the United Arab Emirates. Traffic through the strait, by the way, has practically vanished, further complicating the future of global energy supplies. An Iranian-backed militia in Yemen, called the Houthis, today said it would block shipments from the Bab al-Mandeb Strait to punish Saudi Arabia for recent attacks in Yemen. The Bab al-Mandeb was being used as an overland route to ferry oil to the Red Sea so as to avoid the choked-off Strait of Hormuz. Now, this has been a long-running Houthi threat, and it may be materializing, with unknown consequences for oil prices and regional animosities. What is clear today is hostilities and points of conflict are increasing in number and geographic breadth, while diplomacy is foundering, edging close to what might be described accurately as failure. We begin tonight with CBS News senior national security correspondent Charlie Daggett, who joins us from Amman, Jordan. Charlie, what's the latest?
Well, you know, you had a long laundry list there of what's been happening here, and it has only intensified. In fact, I want to update you. You said nine consecutive nights that U.S. military has been operating. We just learned from Central Command, that's the military in charge of this region, they just started the 10th consecutive night of bombing. You also mentioned dozens of wounded U.S. personnel, almost 100 if you include the entire area, this entire region, and just the past couple of weeks. But we came to Jordan, as you mentioned, the two U.S. service members who were killed here, a third is missing in action from that attack at a base here in Jordan. We're used to talking about Bahrain and Kuwait, but Iran has trained its guns on this country. There have been dozens of wounded just here. There have been four out of five nights Iran has attacked or attempted to attack U.S. facilities here in Jordan. Just yesterday, as you mentioned, Iran tried to fire missiles at Aqaba in the south. They were intercepted. Tonight, wasn't expecting this. We had air raid sirens here in Amman. So that has obviously raised concerns for the Jordanian people who host American forces here. They don't really like to talk about permanent bases. They don't really address the fact that the U.S. military does have a presence here. But Iran certainly knows that they're here, and they have been using precision weapons to attack U.S. facilities, resulting in the deaths of U.S. service members. And that's the first deaths we've seen in months. So that's why we're here, to try to figure out what exactly is going on and why Jordan is now in the crosshairs.
And Charlie, as you try to figure out what's going on, what do we know about how many U.S. personnel are in Jordan? Their ability to defend themselves, meaning use interceptors to stop Iranian missiles, and what their overall mission is from Jordan.
Boy, Major, that is a great question. First of all, they don't like talking about numbers, but there are thousands of U.S. forces here, and they have been part of what's called Operation Inherent Resolve, not Operation Epic Fury. They're not in this fight against Iran. They have been here in the fight against ISIS since 2014. Again, not something that Jordan likes to bang a drum about, but they're here. They're here partially because the U.S. service members that were killed were part of a missile defense systems. There are also F-16 fighter jets here that are based here that have been taking part in military operations throughout this region. That has been established for years. So even with the announcement that we got from Central Command about these two service members who had been killed, they said that was part of Operation Inherent Resolve, not part of Operation Epic Fury.
Interesting. Charlie Daggett from Amman, Jordan. Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it. CBS News National Security Analyst Aaron McClain joins me now. He is also host of the School of War podcast. Aaron, you heard Charlie describe that. What's your reaction?
We are seeing, as you say, a number of possible routes to escalation here. If President Trump follows through on his claim over the weekend that Iran will be made to pay, you could see a broadening of the sorts of targets that we're striking in Iran. By the way, we haven't seen that yet. The strikes since those two service members were killed have been largely in character with what precedes them. The Iranians also have options. They could do a broader array of targets hitting desalinization plants and energy targets in the region. They've not done that yet. The United States could also expand in its operations in the Strait itself. For example, ground troops on some of these islands. That option remains. None of these things have happened yet. The last couple of days seem more or less in line with the week that has preceded them.
How about this thing that the Houthis are threatening to do to Saudi near the Red Sea?
Just when things weren't complicated enough, here we are. Yeah, so this is the other critical waterway running through this neighborhood. Now, it's slightly less acute because the Bab el-Mandeb, which leads to the Red Sea, which leads to the Suez Canal, ultimately is not make or break because ships can take the long route around Africa if they want. That is costly. That is a problem. And in combination with the de facto closure of the Strait of Hormuz that we're looking at right now, if you see increased strikes on shipping in that key waterway, it's only going to have negative effect on prices.
And what Charlie said about the U.S. disposition of forces in Jordan, they're for something else, not necessarily for this theater of operations, though they're in this theater of operations. They're clearly targets, and now there have been casualties.
That's right. And, you know, clearly something has failed here. We have this multi-layered missile defense concept in the U.S. military, as indeed do all militaries. We're able to intercept things from the exo-atmosphere down to very low altitudes, and these different screens are supposed to stop things before they get through, and then there are shelters at the ground level. Clearly, presumably, we can speculate, there are a variety of possible reasons. It could be resource reasons. It could be Iranians shifting their tactics in ways that we don't catch. Things are getting through. It's also possible that troops are not getting to shelters in time. Somewhere, somehow, the system failed.
And when the average American hears, as he or she frequently does, representations by the Pentagon, that there is relentless degrading of Iranian capabilities, and yet these things keep happening, how are they to try to square those two things?
Well, you know, the administration has been making a lot of claims. You could argue that in certain respects, since the beginning of the conflict, there have been a series of overpromises and underdeliveries. And when you linger over and over again on the destruction done to the Iranian missile capabilities, you sort of leave people with the impression that those capabilities have been reduced to zero. They haven't been reduced to zero. They still have the ability to take shots. The campaign that we're seeing in recent days is really focused on the Strait of Hormuz. That is clearly what our military is focused on. You don't see a lot of rhetoric about that. You don't see a lot of explanation about why it's happening. You don't see a lot of justification of the costs on those grounds, which I think leaves people looking at this and seeing a sort of tit-for-tat, a strategic exchange, and wondering, what's it all for?
What's it all for? And more importantly, where is it all heading?
Yeah.
Aaron McLean, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Delegation of victims of Iranian-sponsored terrorism and their families are in Washington demanding action from President Trump. What do they want? They want President Trump to require Iran to pay restitution as part of any future peace deal, whenever that might arise. This delegation spent the day on Capitol Hill advocating for bipartisan legislation that looks to strengthen something called the state-sponsored terror judgments. CBS News correspondent Jonah Kaplan spoke to several of them and joins me now. Jonah, what'd you learn?
Well, Major, first you have to look at the calendar because this is about halfway through, or what would be halfway through, the 60-day memorandum of understanding. So all of these families, these victims, saw what was happening, the MOU, unfreezing of assets, giving Iran potentially billions of dollars in sanctions relief. And here they were being promised and being ordered billions of dollars from summary judgments that Iran was held liable for any number of state-sponsored acts of terrorism, and that money was not coming to them or the United States, but instead going to Iran. So they here had a message. Do not negotiate unless restitution, unless our desires and our laws are being enforced. But also they said they wanted to speak up on behalf of the 20,000 victims and families in America who have been granted some sort of funding from the U.S. Victims of State-Sponsored Terrorism Fund, the Department of Justice.
And Jonah, when we try to think through our mind about these various Iranian-backed offenses, USS Cole is one of them. What are some of the others?
Well, Major, you can go back to 1979 and the hostage crisis. Then you have the 1983 barracks bombings in Beirut. You have the embassy bombings in Tanzania and Kenya. A judge even found that Iran gave material support to al-Qaeda in 9/11. And then, of course, recently, the Hamas-led terrorist attacks in Israel, Hamas being supported by Iran. And when we spoke with these victims, they all said they shared some sort of camaraderie with each other, even if they haven't met. Take a listen to one of the gentlemen.
For each one of those 20,000 people, there's a story of grief and pain. And I don't think any of us here want anyone else to ever have to feel that pain. And so if we have a mechanism where we can hold foreign state sponsors of terror accountable for the pain that they cause, it reduces the chances that that happens in the future.
And Major, when you ask them about, well, is this really about money? Is this really what you want? Is this to get paid? They said, no, it's not about money. It's about accountability. They can't put on trial any one of these leaders of Iran, but they can order them to pay for justice.
Jonah Kaplan on Capitol Hill, I appreciate it very much. Thank you. President Trump acknowledged that the new Qatari gifted Air Force One jet, well, it needs some maxing, meaning security upgrades. He says the process could take a month. Let's bring in our Weijia Jiang, who joins us from the North Lawn of the White House. You saw her a moment ago. Now you see her again. Weijia, great to see you. What do we know about all this?
Well, other than what you said, Major, we don't know much except for the president's comments that it's going to be sent away for about a month to be maxed out begs a couple pretty big questions. One, what is it missing that will be added right now? And two, how much is it going to cost taxpayers? You may remember, Major, the president already took this Qatari-gifted jet out for a spin, even took it to the NATO summit in Turkey. But he actually stopped at an Air Force base, changed planes, and initially went on one of the old planes for his return trip back, which raised a lot of questions about security in the region, because that was a time when the ceasefire had just ended. Ultimately, he did bring the new plane back to the U.S., but it has been out of commission now, and we don't know exactly what's going to be added. I can say that the White House press secretary insists that the plane is perfectly safe for the president to travel on, but it's going to get, additional enhancements.
And that begs the question, Was it as well? It's clear from the president's rhetoric, Weijia, that it wasn't as safe as it could be,
right?
Because you don't add to something if it has everything it needs.
Correct.
And you don't take it out of service if it's maximally safe. So there's something missing here.
That's right. Right. And we don't exactly know what that is. What we do know is that for the traditional Air Force One jets that are used to transport the president, it takes years to beef that up to a point that is secure enough. For example, these old jets have technology that can thwart missiles, that can use lasers to redirect any thing that comes toward the plane's way. That type of technology takes time, and this was a very quickly processed plane. Even though Qatar gifted it to the U.S., it had to be retrofitted by the Pentagon to make sure that it was up to standard. And of course, Major, to your point, the very fact that it is being sent away for more highlights the fact that it is not exactly where it should be to continue taking the president all over the world.
Weijia Jiang in the North Island White House. Thank you very much. Lindsey Graham, former senator, late senator from South Carolina, his sister, Darlene, says she's now going to run for the Senate seat full. She's currently serving in that seat, as you well know, on an interim basis following Graham's death from a heart ailment. President Trump has already weighed in on this, endorsed her in the special election. But that doesn't mean others in South Carolina, Republicans, are not interested. Congressman Russell Fry and Ralph Norman have also entered the race, which is a kind of shocking development. CBS News political director Finn Gomez joins me now. We're also going to get to Maine, but let's talk about South Carolina first. What do we know?
There's some new news that just developed a short time ago, and that is that Congresswoman Nancy Mace, someone who was considering a race, she actually told you in an interview that she was considering a race, did say in a video announcement that she's not going to be running in this race, leaving the field right now. The major headline, of course, is that Darlene Graham has entered into the fray, and she's going to be facing a couple conservative congressmen in Ralph Norman and Russell Fry, which is really interesting. Because it's not going to be clear sailing for her, even with the president's endorsement.
What strikes me about this is that both Russell Fry and Ralph Norman know the president's already in on this, and I'm not sure this is defiance is the right word, but they're making their own political flex here, saying I'm not going to let this moment pass me by. I'm going to give it a try.
Absolutely. And we do know that for example, Ralph Norman reached out to the president early on, literally the day after the news of Lindsey Graham's passing, to ask for his endorsement, the president's endorsement. The president sort of punted and said he wasn't going to enter into the fray at that point. But look, I think it shows one thing. We've seen the president's endorsement, of course, have significant sway in these Republican primaries. But there have been a few instances where they haven't gone full
this
impact.
This is going to be a test case. Let's shift our attention
absolutely.
To Maine very quickly.
Yeah,
there was fascinating developments over the weekend because there were a lot of Maine Democrats seeking the nomination. It's
a very big field.
Concentrated process. There's going to be a convention next Saturday, but it appears basically over.
We essentially have a presumptive nominee in this Democratic Senate race, and that's going to be Troy Jackson, who's the former Senate president, also calls himself a pickup progressive, always wears a baseball hat, is a former Maine logger, had a lot of former Graham Platter supporters working for him, and he's basically secured enough of these delegates. It's not official until next Saturday, as you pointed out, but it looks, his top contenders
dropped
out.
Because a lot of people have dropped out.
All the top contenders essentially have dropped out. Some of the other smaller campaigns remain on the ballot. But look, it's Troy Jackson to lose. He already put out a statement saying, my focus is now who? Susan Collins, the incumbent Republican senator who's running for a sixth term. And now the game is on. The fight is on.
And what we should interpret this as is he's not waiting until Saturday. Saturday's going to happen. It doesn't become official then. But he's essentially starting the statewide campaign against Susan Collins as rapidly as he can. And it appears, and this is the other important consideration, that Democrats seeking this nomination are coalescing behind him. Not only are they dropping out, but they're endorsing.
Yeah, and that's a big question. Can he unify the Democratic Party right now, right? Amid the chaos following Platner's resignation from the race, can he unify the party? And right now, it seems like he can. at this point. He can't just win progressives to win in this race. Susan Collins is a formidable foe who's raised a ton of money and has faced other tough competitors. It's not an easy ride, but Democrats do feel, even with Jackson replacing Planner, that they have a really good shot of winning in this battleground state.
And very quickly, Finn, this at least was a process that Democrats feel that was responsive, transparent, different than 2024.
Different than 2024, but also kind of similar, right? I mean, a truncated time, just like Kamala Harris at the end.
But at least they're involved in this, and there was a process why people could throw their hat in the ring and see what would happen.
Absolutely.
And what happened, it's going to be Troy Jackson.
Learning from their mistakes.
Finn Gomez, always a pleasure, sir. Thank you. Still to come, the Justice Department, according to a new book, has been turned in to the Department of Revenge. Pulitzer Prize winning reporter Devlin Barrett with the memos, a recording, and other evidence of a, quote, charge first, ask question later, DOJ mentality. Also, Andy Burnham becomes the UK's fifth prime minister in 4 years and seventh in a decade. Wow. He's spoken to President Trump and vowed to reverse economic stagnation and political malaise. Good luck with that. Plus, Vice President Vance and Second Lady Usha Vance, parents for a fourth time. Welcome to the world, Alec Neil Vance. The Takeout returns in 90 seconds. Welcome back to The Takeout. Aggressive immigration enforcement has led to wave upon wave of deportations. It has also sparked national protests. 9 people have been killed by federal agents. There's also been violence directed at immigration agents and facilities. Let's pick up on that last one. Today, according to authorities, an anti-ICE activist set off an incendiary device of some kind and then tried to spread what authorities believe to be gasoline outside a federal building in Lower Manhattan. That building houses FBI and Immigration and Customs and Enforcement offices. The atmosphere around immigration is tense, and tripwires seemingly can be found everywhere. In this atmosphere, the federal government has dramatically increased the arrest and charging of people accused of assaulting or impeding officers, but many of these cases have fallen apart, either in court or before they've gotten to court, due to insufficient evidence or other defects. Now, federal cases, we should note, rarely collapse like this. The DOJ typically wins 90% of charged cases. New York Times investigative reporter Mike McIntyre was part of an investigation that looked into this, and he joins me now. He's also the author of a new book called Ricochet, Guns, Greed, and the American Way of Violence. Congratulations on the book, Mike, but let's talk about this piece that appeared in Sunday's New York Times. A deep dive into the number of cases and their disposition. What are the big takeaways?
Well, thanks for having me, first of all. We started seeing cases toward the end of last year and early this year of people charged with assaulting federal agents during the immigration raids that were falling apart, cases that were being dismissed or acquitted by juries. And we wondered how widespread this was. Now, there's no easy way to kind of go into the court dockets and right away figure out how many are immigration related. So we had to spend months going through thousands of pages of court documents until we found over 550 of these cases and got records for every single one of them, reviewed hearing transcripts, looked at video, interviewed people. What we found is that, as you said earlier, more than 90% typically of federal criminal cases are successful. Here, we're hovering around a success rate of about 50%. And what we're finding is that many of these cases just never should have been brought in the first place, and that juries and judges are basically saying they don't believe the federal government.
And they don't believe the federal government because either the video evidence doesn't back them up or eyewitness testimony does not back up the initial assertions.
Oftentimes it's video. You will see affidavits, sworn statements submitted into court by federal agents saying that one thing happened, that an immigrant or a protester attacked them. And then video surfaces either from video body cams or someone's Ring doorbell video, which basically disproves the entire narrative. These have been criticized broadly by judges who are getting sort of tired of some of this. We found at least 30 cases in which judges admonished the government, either prosecutors or agents, for destroying or withholding evidence, for making exaggerated claims, and other misconduct.
Mike, it also says in the report, In dozens of cases, I'm reading from it directly, court records and videos show that federal agents were the first to get physical, including shoving, tackling, or pepper spraying defendants. Many defendants successfully argued that the assaults they were accused of were actually acts of self-defense.
Yeah, I mean, that's not something you see hardly at all before this immigration crackdown happened. And a good example of one of these type cases is one that we highlighted in our story. It involved two young mothers in Charlotte, North Carolina, who were engaged in a peaceful protest against immigration raids in their community. And basically in response to that, they were followed in their car by a couple of unmarked vehicles with masked and armed men in them who proceeded to corner them in a driveway. And when the women were terrified, they were calling 911 asking for help. While they were doing this inside the car, one of the agents proceeded to smash the driver's side window using the barrel of his rifle to do it. They took the women out, arrested them, charged them with assault. No assault occurred on their part. And pretty soon prosecutors dropped that case. They dismissed it because there's no way to proceed with it. But that's sort of one example of the kind of claims that were being filed by the federal government in these cases that in some cases really kind of, you know, disrupted people's lives, left them terrified, and then only to see them vanish later when they encountered any kind of scrutiny.
And Mike, very quickly, the federal government is using a seldom used statute, as I understand, to broaden this definition of impeding a federal officer to mean almost anything.
Yeah, I mean, this one statute is called 18 U.S.C. 111, makes it a crime to assault or forcibly impede a federal agent in the conduct of their duties. The key word here is forcibly. There has to be something more than just simply, you know, following someone in their car. If you're a protester or blowing a whistle or engaging in some constitutionally protected speech. And that component has been missing in many, many of these cases. And so it's really kind of a misuse of this particular statute that has never been seen before.
It's a thoroughly documented piece of American journalism, and I recommend it to everyone. Mike McIntyre of the New York Times, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Takeout, New York Times doubleheader, an example of weaponization of the government, the Trump administration. That's the allegation. We're going to speak to the author of a new book who says the Department of Justice is now turning its attention toward the president's perceived political enemies. That's next here on The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Welcome to the Conversation Corner. Here's a look at what else we and now you are watching this evening. This morning, Andy Burnham became the United Kingdom's newest prime minister. Britain, as you well know, has been embroiled in political upheaval since the 2016 Brexit referendum, when the Brits voted to leave the European Union. Burnham, now head of the Labour Party, as you can see, spoke outside of Downing Street today. Earlier, he has denounced British politics, where he says, quote, power was centralized and economic power was privatized. He said he's going to reverse all that. Good luck to him. The FDA says the lettuce sample from Taylor Farms that tested positive for an infectious parasite that has sickened thousands of Americans was, pay attention, a false positive. However, the FDA still says Taylor Farms is the focus of its investigation into the lettuce from central Mexico, which might be the source of all this. In a statement, Taylor Farms said, quote, our thoughts remain with everyone who has fallen ill in this outbreak. We are committed to working with public health authorities as the ongoing outbreak investigation continues, unquote. At least 5,000 cases in Michigan alone have been confirmed. No deaths have been reported. A new book with lots of sources from inside the Justice Department details how President Trump has altered, and some might say radically altered, Justice Department procedures. The book, The Department of Revenge, also gives new insight in how this administration has used the Department of Justice to pursue the president's perceived political enemies. The author, Devlin Barrett, multiple Pulitzer Prize winner, joins me now. He covers the Justice Department for the New York Times. It's great to have you here. We'll get to the book in a second, but you had two really important stories recently that I want to talk about.
Sure.
Federal agents were told FBI will no longer investigate ICE confrontations. Where are we on that?
So this went out in written form on Thursday.
Both the Justice Department and the Department of Homeland Security have since said this isn't going to happen. They're not going to do it. But I think you have to keep in mind that there has been so much back and forth on federal policy of the ICE enforcement operation that I think there's just so much tension, as you already reported and covered, there's so much tension and disagreement inside federal law enforcement about these assault on a federal officer cases that I don't think this is the end of it.
Got it. You also had a story about what the president said Thursday night in a primetime address about fake IDs in China.
Right. So this gets back to one of Trump and his supporters' arguments about how he was supposedly treated unfairly during the 2020 election cycle. It cites essentially an FBI informant who came forward with a pretty wild story about the Chinese government supposedly using fake IDs to try to mass produce bad ballots.
One agent in Albany with a subsource who didn't even have direct information.
Correct. So there was a lot of internal within the FBI. There was a lot of internal skepticism when this report first circulated. And the Republicans argue that skepticism is itself bias against Trump. But I think realistically, what you see here is really emblematic of how messy and murky the intelligence gathering process is.
Indeed. And what the president said even went farther than this one FBI agent with a subsource suggested, which was just ballots might be manipulated. President Trump jumped to for Joe Biden.
Right. And also in the speech, he frankly mangled the premise, which was that he said that they were manufacturing false mail-in ballots. That's not actually what the informant originally said in the first place. But, you know, there is a leapfrog here of logic that goes on with some of these allegations.
So I've read 2/3 of the book. I spent all morning doing that. And the central question here is, this is not, or is it, the common disagreements that sometimes federal officials will have about direction and prioritization? I've been in Washington for 40 years. That happens a lot.
All the time.
What you're saying in this book is this is not that. This is something fundamentally different.
Yes. And I wouldn't have written a book about like the usual arguments. Oh, look, the Justice Department and FBI are built around arguments, are built around disagreements. Lifelong federal law enforcement people tell you, we get to better cases, we get to better results when we kick things around, when we disagree, when we, you know, those disagreements lead us.
When we argue about the validity of underlying evidence.
Absolutely.
And the applicability of federal law.
Absolutely. This is different. This is about what was described to me over and over and over again is replacing a core principle of the Justice Department, a principle of prosecutorial discretion, meaning career prosecutors make determinations and they get vetted up the chain. Their superiors sign off on them. But fundamentally, it's a bottom-up process to determine who should be charged with crimes.
And what you find is top-down over and over and over, directional impulses from the top saying, go do this.
Absolutely. And not only that, go do this. And in many instances, it's go do this or you're fired. And that is why I wrote the book, because I think there's something very important happening in the Justice Department right now. I'm not trying to write, you know, a boo-hoo book or a sky is falling book. That's not my point at all. But I think, I covered the Justice Department for more than 25 years. I care very much about, I don't care about a building. I don't care about an institution. I don't care about a badge. What I care about are the principles of justice that are really fundamental to how our country operates. And that is what I think is important about what's happening.
Because there have been instances I saw in this book where people are like, wait a minute, it's not there. It's just not there.
Right.
And the answer is, we don't care if it's not there. Go pursue it anyway.
And you see that in cases, in the two standout cases, which I sort of break down, the first case against Jim Comey, the former FBI director, the case against Letitia James, the New York Attorney General. Those were both cases that the president himself publicly demanded. And when career prosecutors would not deliver the cases he wanted, he put someone else in those jobs.
Devlin Barrett, I'm glad you're here. I'm going to have you back for a longer conversation, I promise, if you'll be kind enough to come back.
Happy to.
The book, The Department of Revenge, How Trump Took Control of American Justice. It's great stuff. Thank you so much. Coming up, the Vances welcome a new baby. What we know about how little Alec spent his first few days. That's next here on The Takeout. Welcome back. Vice President J.D. Vance and Second Lady Usha Vance announced the birth of their fourth child, Alec Neil Vance, born Sunday, Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, Bethesda. Olivia Rinaldi joins me now. Olivia, you know all the history about this.
I have learned.
You wrote a nice memo to us, and I looked at that. I'm like, let's get Olivia out at the family table. What happened? So what's going on?
So this is the first time in modern history that a vice president has had a child while in office. The last time this happened was 156 years ago. Schuyler Colfax Jr., who was vice president to Ulysses S. Grant.
Yes.
And he.
I didn't know that.
It's okay. It's okay. He had his son with his wife in 1870. That's the last known time. I'm going to say known time there because we don't know everyone's business all the time. But that's the last known time that this has happened.
Reporters weren't as nosy in the late 19th century as they are now.
Maybe he just got buried. I don't know. Who but knows? That was the last time. And then right before that
metaphorically
was. Metaphorically. And then 10 years before that was Hannibal Hamlin, who was vice president to Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln.
He had his son Frank in 1862. And then before that, John C. Calhoun, to two different presidents, had two sons. He had a son when he was serving as vice president in 1826 to John Quincy Adams, and then 1829 to Andrew Jackson. It was two of his 10 children. Two of 10. So those are the three times we've known.
We have got your vice presidential baby bingo card completely filled out, ladies and
gentlemen.
Guys,
I spent a lot of time on this.
Run wild with it. Run wild with it.
I spent a lot of time on this. But this is the fourth time that in known history. I keep saying known history because who knows what.
You know. Right.
But this is the fourth time in known history that a vice president has had a child while in office.
And everything's going well so far as we know.
Everything's going well. I was told that they're in baby bliss right now. They're having a great time. Another fun fact that I found out during all this research was the term second lady was not something that was used back then. So I'm looking up who a second lady is, you know, which second lady had children back then. And that word was not coming up in the research because that was not known as a word that was used for the wife of a vice president until 1890. Was first used back then and then fully adopted really at the turn of the century when you're starting to get the wives of, you know, the great presidents.
And Olivia, before I let you go, remind the audience the names of the Vance's now four children.
Yes, they're now four children. Ewan, who's age 9, he's the oldest. Then you have Vivek, who is 6 years old. They have a daughter, Mirabel, she's 4. And now we have Alec Neil Vance, just 1 day old. Today's Monday.
Olivia Rinaldi with all of the great details and some John C. Calhoun stuff you'll only get at the Takeout. I'm telling you, folks. Coming up next, progressives. Well, this has been happening for a while, but there's another one behind Abdul Al-Sayed in Michigan. Elizabeth Warren, Democratic progressive from Massachusetts. This primary reflects, you know it, the national divide among Democrats, progressive and moderates, perceived and otherwise. More on that when we come back. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to Takeout Political Panel Time. Let me introduce you. Democratic strategist, CBS News political contributor Chuck Rocha. Republican strategist, former communications director for the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Leslie Shedd. Leslie, let me talk to you because you just got back from Ukraine. You were there for a week.
Yep.
What'd you see? What'd you hear?
We went everywhere, honestly. We went all the way out to the east. We went into the Donbass to a place called Pavlograd. We got to meet with some air assault brigades there. We came back. We had a really substantive meeting with President Zelensky. We got to meet with the foreign minister. And my big takeaway from all of this is that Ukraine is winning. And Ukraine is doing some very cool things with drones, with weapons. The United States really should get in the business of this. It is like a giant laboratory there.
And it can teach us to do things we need to learn in
pretty quick. Absolutely. I mean, you've got some American companies that are there. We met with Shield AI, and they are having some really great success, especially providing overflight. So they send their drones in to kind of see what's going on the battlefield to help as some of the, you know, assault drones will go in. But an interesting fact that I learned is that, you know, when you look at the front lines, there's about 7 times as many Russian troops on the front lines there, but that they are dying at a rate of 6 times faster than Ukrainians. And it is because Ukrainians have figured out a way to use technology to replace human beings. So they are able to go in using nothing but drones from far away and make huge gains against the Russians.
That's fantastic stuff. Chuck, I want to talk to you about Michigan. Senate primary, Abdul El-Sayed and Haley Stevens running against each other, one a perceived moderate, one a perceived progressive. That's what they call themselves. That's how they position themselves. How big of a race is this to understand the Democratic Party writ large in this election cycle?
I think it shows that there's a lot of anxiety amongst the electorate. We have to separate things here, and I know you have to get into the weeds on the politics here, is a Democratic primary is somewhat of a reflection of the general, but it's a regular general or an off-year general. And what I'm getting at that for all of you at home is that in an off-year election, there's such a smaller group of people that vote. And so in a primary, there's even a smaller group of people. And right now, to your point, the Democratic Party is trying to figure out which part of the Democratic Party is going to actually win this. In New York, you saw some outcomes, and in California. But what will be reflective when we get to November? That's what the overall party is looking at, when about 60% of Democrats who don't participate at all in the primaries will show up to vote in a general election. We don't know yet.
And when those in the Democratic Party say Abdul El-Sayed is simply too liberal or too progressive for Michigan, what are they actually saying?
Folks, look, I work for Bernie Sanders, and I'll say this.
That's what I mean, because you've heard this before. Right. You've heard this before.
They said the same thing about Donald Trump. Guess who's in the White House right now? Donald Trump.
Because energy matters.
Absolutely. And Donald Trump, and I give him credit for this as a Democrat, is that he got a lot of people who normally don't vote to show up in a regular election and on the general. That's part of the problem with Republicans right now, is they're trying to figure out that energy to get those folks back to vote in the midterm. It's just math in these things, and I'll promise you, I'll say it's not too progressive to win in November.
You believe that?
I truly believe that. But okay. I think it's a good year for Democrats, because somebody's doing something great.
Leslie, I have a good friend. I know you know him. I know you know him too, Chuck, Ron Brownstein. He's a great writer. He's very deep in the numbers. And he wrote a column that I read today. Talks about something that the Democrats have yet to have done in this cycle that they did in 2018. Let me read it to you. 2018, the share of voters who disapproved of Trump's performance was about 10 points larger than the share who approved. Today, Trump's net approval rating is 20 points negative, twice as negative as it was. And yet the Democratic leader of the generic ballot in 2026 is smaller than the party's advantage in 2018 when it was 8.5%, meaning there are lots more people who are dissatisfied, but less than 2018 that Democrats have persuaded to come in their direction. This appears to be right now a structural issue for the Democrats and a possible thin silver lining for Republicans.
I mean, I think it's a big silver lining for us. Like you said, you're talking about a 5-point difference in the generic ballot, and that is huge. I think some of this has to do with the candidates that they're selecting, and not necessarily in those states, right? But rather when people see the type of candidates that are winning in some of these New York congressional races, for example, it turns them away from the Democratic Party. It brings them back to this idea of, you know, the woke policy that scared people off in 2024. They're just not going to like that. I also think, too, that there are a lot of Democrats, not all of them, certainly, but a lot of them that don't seem to have a policy platform other than we hate Donald Trump. And so they're not necessarily providing voters a list of things that they are for, a list of things that they're going to do for them. They're just saying, we're not going to be Donald Trump. And I don't think that's going to be enough.
Chuck, I know you want to jump in, and you have and are living through real world experience with one of those who you were working for in Texas, James Tallarico. If this is true, this is something he needs to solve in Texas and Democrats need to address.
Republicans have been in charge in D.C. right now of all branches of our government. And in Texas, they've been in charge for 31 years. Right now, there's an anti-incumbency going on with both parties, but really with Republicans, they've been in charge. And guess what? I give them credit. I'm one of the few Democrats who do. When you win elections, you got to fix some things. And people really are hurting right now. And it's easy for a Democrat to say, oh, it's Donald Trump's point to my friend's point there. But it's harder now to say, I've got a vision.
You don't disbelieve this data that Ron Brownstein's talking about.
Trump is
more unpopular, and yet Democrats have yet to translate it affirmatively for them.
We're working in congressional races from the East Coast to the West Coast, and every marginal seat in America, and it's backed up with these numbers. There's anxiety. They want to vote for Democrats. They're going to vote for Democrats. At what level yet? We still have yet to be determined, because we have a long way to Election Day.
Leslie, you get the last word.
I mean, I know what Chuck is saying here. I just think that at the end of the day, the American people want something to be for, too. They can't just be against something. And I think that a lot of these socialist and in some instances, self-proclaimed communist candidates are scaring people away from the Democratic Party. And it's reminding them of the woke policies of 2024 they didn't like.
It will be interesting to see if one local candidate in one particular jurisdiction can scare an entire national electorate. We'll see. Chuck Rocha, Leslie Shedd, great to have you here. Happy Monday, everyone. You tried to trick me, camera. It's not Friday. This is The Takeout. Relentlessly curious, reliably civil, occasionally clever, and I do pay attention.
Everything has to come to an end. now streaming only on Paramount Plus. The acclaimed series, The Chi, reaches its final chapter.
We from Chicago. It's my home.
From Emmy Award winner Lena Waithe.
There are two types of people in this world. Those that reach for more and those that just enjoy what they got.
This The Chi. Anything's possible.
Singing this song to you.
The Chi, the final season now streaming only on Paramount Plus.